Well, I had some duties last Friday. Friday's my day off, but Friday I had some duties to take care of, a few errands, this and that, and about 1:30 in the afternoon I was on my way home, and my wife makes fun of me for doing this, but I go to movies by myself. I have since I was a little kid. Go to movies by myself. I am my own best friend. I don't need companionship. So I'm driving home, and I happen to note that my path home takes me past one of the largest Cineplexes in the St. Louis area, and I thought to myself, you know, Wednesday, the Matrix movie came out, and it's 1:30 on a Friday afternoon, and I think if I'm going to see it this weekend, and I have to see it because I'm going to be talking to Brian Goodell about it on Monday, I better see it now. I went, I got my ticket, I sat down, prime spot, and I watched it. We're going to talk about The Matrix Reloaded. Maybe you saw it this weekend. A record-setting $139 million since Wednesday. That's for an R-rated movie. It's a record since its Wednesday opening. Brian Goodell is a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching the Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. We'll talk about the sequel to The Matrix and the worldview that it represents. In hour three of the program, our conclusion for the series that we're doing with Dr. Arthur Hunt on a word-based culture versus an image-based culture. We're going to talk about the paganizing tendency of the image and the irrationality of what he calls spectacle. It'll go nicely with this conversation, I think. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And if you haven't seen the new Matrix movie, do not fear to listen. We won't give away any of the plot twists or the secrets. Brian Goodell, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, it's great to be here.
Brian, tell us about this now running two movies, The Matrix and the second of the three, The Matrix Reloaded.
What? Tell you about it?
Yeah, just tell us the basic premise,
the basic
plot.
Gotcha. Well, for those of you who have been living on another planet, The Matrix is the story of a young hacker named Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, who basically gets caught into this labyrinth of espionage and discovers that all of humanity, or all of what we think is real, is actually a giant illusion created by a huge computer operating program, and we're all enslaved to artificial intelligence. And so these people free him from that, and there's two worlds then. There's the illusionary world that people live in, and there's the real world, and Neo struggles with discovering and finding out whether or not he's the prophesied one, the one who is to come and free all the people from the Matrix. And that was basically the first story, and that was his dilemma going in there. And then the second, Matrix Reloaded, is it kind of continues the fight as he now has his new, he realized that he is the one, and he has these new Superman-like powers. He's able to bend or distort the rules of the Matrix, since it's just a computer program, and he's able to engage in Superman-like feats while he and his companions try to somehow figure out how they can take down this huge, you know, artificial intelligence machine, at the same time that the machines are seeking all these people who have been freed from the Matrix in a little underground cavern called Zion, and the machines are trying to track them down so that they can kill them and take back control.
Now, someone's going to hear the basic storyline here, and they're going to say, look, this sounds like your average kind of sci-fi action thriller, but you devote an entire section of your book to this first film, The Matrix. Why?
Well, because I think that it has, for a couple reasons, but I think it has this sort of important impact that on sci-fi movies as well as movies in general, very similar to the way Blade Runner did many years ago. Blade Runner became sort of the archetype of the cool science fiction movie, and I think Matrix has now taken that over. But Matrix has also gone one step further, and what it did was it really brought in intelligent philosophical world views into what would otherwise be considered sort of a raw, entertaining sort of story. And I think that it because of that, it's very important, because it becomes not only very popular on the entertainment front, many people love to watch the kung fu fights and the sci-fi technology, but it really, in an in-depth way, goes into presenting a worldview of a way of looking at the world about the nature of reality, the nature of knowledge, the nature of right and wrong. And it sort of brings that in an in-depth way that movies haven't been able to get away with for years.
What is the worldview presented by the first and the second film that just opened on Wednesday?
Well, I would pretty much call it, as I do in my book, pretty much a postmodern worldview. And what that is there's a few things that would label it that. And by the way, you know, the writer directors, the Wachowski brothers, they're very self-consciously postmoderns. They make references in the first movie to a famous postmodern philosopher named Jean Baudrillard in one of the books that Neo opens up, and they had given that book to Keanu Reeves personally and told him to read it before he did the movie. So, and in that book, which they show in the first movie, it's called Simulacra and Simulacrum, and the basic principle is that there is no real reality, there's just copies. There are no originals, there's only copies, and that's what the kind of reality we're living in now is. And so they sort of, you know, embody that philosophy in the movie as well. But it's postmodern because it not only does it question the nature of reality, which is a very hallmark of postmodernism, you know, it makes us really think, you know, how do you know what's real and what isn't? How do you know you're not in a dream state right now and everything you think real is only an illusion? And it deals with that issue, at least in the first movie. And then the second movie, the theme of the second movie that they deal with is the nature of determinism and indeterminism, or determinism and free will. You know, that whole historical, philosophical debate through the centuries, they take that on, and they maintain that depth in the second movie that they had in the first movie, which is what I really liked about it. But it's also postmodern in the sense that postmodernism is sort of marked by an eclectic shoving together of incongruent elements. Like, you know, you might have postmodern architecture where you've got, you know, 60s looking, you know, retro looking stuff combined with modern looking stuff, you know, that kind of a approach. And in the Matrix, they have an eclectic mixture of religions, everything from, they use symbols and ideas from Christianity to Buddhism to Hellenistic philosophy, and they mix them up in that movie in sort of a, you know, look at this is sort of the nature of all religions. They're all sort of very much similar to what Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist, used to preach, that all religions are sort of one. They're all sort of combined together. But I think that the Reloaded is taking it a little step further, and I have some speculation on that, but we can talk about that in a minute. But, you know, that's what basically makes it postmodern. It's this eclectic mixture and of incongruent ideas of religion, and it also questions reality.
Now, someone's going to say at this point, look, the worldview you've just articulated that is put forth by the Matrix movies, the first and the second, this is incongruent with the Christian worldview. Therefore, of what possible use could a Christian have for seeing either of these movies?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it's a good challenge. I think, first of all, I want to say that we live in a fallen world, and I don't think that there's anything that's perfect in this world. Everything's got a taint of sin on it. There's no perfect movie. There's no perfect TV show. There's no perfect sermon or Christian book either, you know, for those who are interested in that. I mean, so I think the goal of our life as adults is to learn discernment so that we can, and particularly with the arts, we need to learn, movie appreciation 101. We need to learn sort of the elements of storytelling so we can see how and what the filmmakers are communicating to us. And as we do so, we're able to be more objective and less manipulated, and we can also discern what's the good and what's the bad. And I think that there's some good and some bad in the Matrix. But I think, secondly, it's important that if we want to interact redemptively with our culture, that is, if we want to actually communicate a Christianity that is relevant and that people will listen to us, we have to understand the language they're speaking. And the language they're speaking, one of the dominant languages is, of course, movies. Right now, so many people are watching the movie, the buzz is about it. And, you know, if you don't agree with some things in the movie, that's a great opportunity, as you discuss with other people when they're talking about the Matrix, you can discuss, well, here's what I liked, and here's where I disagreed, and it's a wonderful opportunity to talk about the truth as you know it, applied through the eyes of as the people in the world see.
Now, the movie itself is, as you mentioned, full of symbols, but one must really just kind of fixate upon the kung fu and the chase scenes to miss the religious overtone. Some of the characters, in fact, really, in some cases, all of the characters are quasi-religious figures. Tell us about this.
Yeah, definitely. You know, in fact, I'd say that, you know, The Matrix is pretty much just a series of kung fu fights interspersed with a series of philosophical debates, you know? And, but... Yeah, you know, the they're very clearly and deliberately using religious imagery. In the first movie, of course, it was, I think it was stronger than in the second movie, but in the second movie there's still some religious symbols and references. I just think that they're a little bit more surface in the second movie. The first movie was a little richer and more fuller. But the first movie was basically embodying the Christ myth. And that is, you know, the notion that Neo, who basically is struggling with his identity, coming to discover who is he, and he is the prophesied, the one who is prophesied who would come and save everyone from the Matrix. And of course, at first he doesn't like this idea. He's not sure who he is, and that's very consistent with the Eastern version of the Christ myth. Christ is an office that many people fulfill through history, and Neo is one of many we discover through history. And that's mentioned in the first movie as well as the second. And so that's very much of an Eastern Christ myth. But then there's also a lot of Christian ideas that are mixed in there, you know, symbolism like the word, the name of Trinity, and, you know, Neo's dressed in a black priest's frock coat in the second movie. And there's a lot of surface, you know, references. But essentially it's a Christ myth. And to me the issue is it deals with the contrast of the Judeo-Christian Christian Christ myth versus the Eastern Christ myth. And I think by the second movie, the Eastern Christ myth sort of comes out on top, and it becomes more specifically related. What I mean by that is the Judeo-Christian, you know, Christ story is basically an individual, not an office. He fulfills an office, but it's primarily an individual, and that individual saves people. They don't save themselves. They have to be saved from someone outside of themselves, and that's Judeo-Christianity. But in the Matrix concept, you know, in the second movie, you know, someone comes up to Neo and he basically says, look, Neo says, look, I didn't find you, you found me. Whereas in the Bible, you know, it talks about God finding us, and like a shepherd finding lost sheep. And then the kid says, you saved me, Neo, you saved me. And Neo says, no, I didn't save you, you saved yourself. And so there's a very strong Buddhist element there where, you know, he shows the way, he models what we can all be, but he doesn't actually save people. And that's sort of how where the focus that the Christ myth takes in the Matrix so far.
Now, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that really kind of resolved for me something that, you know, I watched it with great enthusiasm, because I think the movies are just, well, they're cool. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, definitely.
But it resolved for me something that was I found disturbing in the second film, and I think you put it well, that where it was really kind of a genuine reflection of the Christ story in the first one. In the second one, that gives way to a very different story about a very different kind of a Christ. I'm not giving any secrets away to say that in the first movie, the Christ figure, Neo, experiences a death and a resurrection of sorts. Is that theme carried through in the second one without giving any secrets about the second one away?
Yeah, well, you know, he ends up being able, because he can manipulate the Matrix, he's able to do some rather miraculous things, but really he's just scientifically manipulating the Matrix, technically. So, and actually that kind of falls in line with the naturalistic interpretation of Christianity, that if Jesus was able to raise from the dead or do miracles, it was not because he had supernatural powers, but he just understood something about nature that we don't understand, you know. And that falls, again, more in line with the Buddhist way of thinking, where people, avatars or Buddhas or bodhisattvas, they're the higher enlightened people, and they just simply they've awakened to their true deity within, and they're able to help other people see that, and so they seem to have more powers than others, but really they're just on a sort of a higher plane of nature than other people, you know. So yeah, that's carried over.
We're talking about the sequel to the blockbuster movie called The Matrix, The Matrix Reloaded. It earned a whopping $139 million since its opening Wednesday last week. Brian Gadawa is our guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California. Brian, there's a phrase that occurs at least twice in the second movie that seems to have some great significance, and that is, some things change, some do not. What in the world is... What worldview is being put forward here by this simple phrase?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a sense in which that's just sort of a truism that everybody believes in one sense or another. I mean, I believe some things change and some things don't, you know. So I think that maybe just understanding it in the broader context.
Linking it to what you said before, that there's a very heavy dose of Eastern thought, and in particular Eastern thought with regard to determinism, man's fate, or, as they say very plainly in the movie, choice.
Yeah. In this movie, what I liked about it was that it wrestles with the issue of free will versus determinism, choice versus providence, destiny versus, you know, the free agency of man. And they use all those terms throughout the movie, so it's very clear they're wrestling with that issue. I think that what they're actually sort of starting to deal with, and we're not going to know till the final movie, till more revelations are made, but I think there's some suggestions in this movie that there's a reference to causality, cause and effect, as being the underlying reality, and people wanting to have choice versus just being a result of cause and effect, scientific laws. But I think that's what this movie's dealing with is like, okay, if we're all result of programs, you know, if we're all result of natural laws, well, then are we really free to choose? And several points in the movie, we find out that people, you know, without giving too much away again, we discover that there are some situations that we thought were free individuals, but it turns out that they may just be simply programs themselves. And which really sort of shatters that illusion that, oh my gosh, you know, even people we thought were real human beings might turn out to be programs. And programs start to evolve in this movie, the second movie, where they evolve and change sort of like a virus, you know. And we know that that's going to lead on to something in the third movie. What exactly, I'm not sure. But there's this changing, evolving, I think it might actually be going in the direction of the movie AI by Steven Spielberg and that notion is this idea that self-consciousness and humanity comes out of the evolutionary process of increasing complexity. In other words, we think we're unique individuals, but that we're different from other nature, but really we're just part of nature, and that becomes so complex that it grows a self-consciousness out of that complexity, and which is similar to what some theories on artificial intelligence is. Artificial intelligence is just increased computer complexity to the point where it can start to have its own self-awareness, its own self-consciousness. And this would all be strictly a naturalistic worldview. And I think there's some hinting of that in the second movie, but I can't say that it's very definite. It's just sort of hinted at. So that's why I have to say we're going to have to see what happens in the last movie. You know?
Well, I got to say you're opening my eyes, Brian, because I was going to ask you about the theme that ran very strongly through the first movie and whether or not it was carried through in the second movie, and that is man versus machine.
Yes.
In the second movie, without giving secrets away, is that man versus machine maintained, given what you just said? AI, that movie, basically said man is a machine.
Yes, man is simply a machine who is evolved to such complexity that he takes a new step in evolution where he creates for himself a belief structure of religion. And see, that's where it might fit in with the Matrix, too, see, is that this naturalistic worldview ultimately dashes all the religious imagery. Religion simply becomes man's symbolic way of expressing the unknown, which is ultimately scientific laws. And of course, we're also dealing here with, you know, scientific laws in the guise of computer programming. But another element in the movie that they deal with a lot is this notion of purpose, which is sort of an interesting idea because you know, purpose and destiny is something Christians have talked about for a long time, that there is no such thing as just arbitrary reality. Without purpose, there is no meaning and there is no value, and everything is just absurd and chaotic. And in this movie, they make the point that, you know, man is not free. You know, some of the individuals make the point that man is not free. It's his only, you know, his only purpose is to discover the purpose, not the how, and the, not the how of things are, not why things are the way they are, but what is the purpose? What is your purpose? So that's stressed a lot in this movie, which, again, purpose can only make sense in the context of a supernatural or a personal transcendent being like God, or as I think that they might be hinting, purpose can reside in programming, which ultimately reduces to natural laws. You've got all these computer programs that are written for everything in the universe that these people are seeing, from the birds in the sky to the trees that they see planted. They're all guided by programs that have a purpose by someone else. And so, again, you're sort of playing with this idea that what you think is a transcendent purpose might just be part of the purpose of a program, which could be reducible to evolutionary laws. Or you might say, well, purpose, even if it's programmed, purpose can only come from intelligence. And again, it's something they're struggling with in the movie, but I'm not sure that they're definitely taking sides yet.
Brian Godawa is our guest. If you'd like to join us, if you have a question or a comment on the movie The Matrix and its sequel that came out this last week, The Matrix Reloaded, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. With about a minute before we go to a break, Ty is calling from his car. Ty, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, guys. I'll make this quick. I wanted to say briefly that in my own religious tradition, there is room for avatars in a certain sense, in the sense that the apostles and the prophets and even the priests do play a station. They play the station of Christ vicariously, and I thought that was rather poignant with Neo's getup. But I would like your guest very much to address, what is the malignancy in this movie? What is the nature of the enemy? I mean, obviously, the agent is Legion in his ability to multiply himself. But I would like him to address, what is the threat here? What is the evil, and what is being conveyed by that in the movie?
That is a tremendous question, Ty. Yeah. Thank you very much. Get started on the answer. We've only got about a minute before we go to a break, and I'll catch you off.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. The first movie, the enemy, the notion of redemption was in the first movie was enlightenment, that is, ignorance. Man's problem is he's ignorant of the true nature of things. And so his salvation or redemption lies in waking up and realizing this. Now, this is Gnosticism. This is Neoplatonism. This is, Eastern view, right? And that's sort of the essence of the redemption in the first movie. We can talk about the rest after the break.
Brian Godawa is our guest. Folks, this movie, people are going to say, look, movies are just movies. They're just flickering lights on a screen and just there to entertain us in our idle hours. And that may well be true, but they are also expressions of the deep-seated worldviews that you will find every single day in your workplace, in your family, among your friends and your relatives. And that's why we talk about the worldviews connected with movies that not only do they earn money, but they influence the way people think, not only about entertainment, but about their everyday lives. We're talking about the sequel to The Matrix called The Matrix Reloaded. And by the way, the next one's coming out. I don't think we'll have to wait too long to see how things turn out. Brian Godawa is our guest. He's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching the Movies with Wisdom and Discernment. And that's the real purpose of a conversation like this. Not just to talk about the movies, but to talk about what the movies say and are saying, what they're communicating to us in subtle ways that we may be able to discern or not, to build our skill in discerning those very things. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. The Senate has passed a $15 billion AIDS relief bill. The measure will focus a good part of the prevention effort on abstinence programs. Pro-family groups say that will tremendously benefit the people of Africa. David Brody reports from Washington.
Just weeks ago, it appeared this bill was going to include more of the condom approach than abstinence. Peter Brandt, with Focus on the Family, is relieved.
But by and large, it's acceptable. It's a much better bill than might have been.
The House passed a bill that guaranteed a third of the money would go towards abstinence programs. The Senate has now agreed as well.
What we saw was the White House get involved, saying that certain things had to change to the Hyde bill to really make it acceptable.
You can also credit pro-family groups who turned up the heat on lawmakers.
I believe that this is a sunrise on the African continent.
Michael Schwartz is with Concerned Women for America. He says the condom-pushing liberal lawmakers have lost a key battle.
It's a horrible defeat for them. Senator Feinstein fought her best to take the abstinence provision out. She lost on a vote of 52 to 45. Now both houses have gone on record on roll call votes in favor of abstinence.
But this is more than a political fight. This is about saving lives.
When you send people condoms, you're telling them, go engage in these risky activities. And when they do that, they get sick and they die.
Exhibit A is Africa, where condoms have been tried again and again with nothing to show for it. Now it's time to give abstinence a chance. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The bill also includes a provision stating that faith-based organizations do not have to deliver a message they don't believe in, so they can stay on topic with a true abstinence message, avoiding talk of condoms, and still receive money. The president has indicated he will sign the bill. It could be on his desk by Memorial Day. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 Tuesday on AM 850 KFUO, join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Charles Heiser, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Botany at Indiana University in Bloomington and author of Weeds in My Garden, Observations on Some Misunderstood Plants. We'll also talk with Christy Pettit, author of Starving, A Personal Journey Through Anorexia, on Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
What were the beliefs, teachings, and practices of the first evangelicals? Find out with the book, The Spirituality of the Cross, by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. The Spirituality of the Cross is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Spirituality of the Cross is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. The Spirituality of the Cross, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. If you have a question or a comment as we talk about the sequel to the great movie The Matrix, called The Matrix Reloaded, that recently opened, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Brian Gadawa is our guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, and we're talking about the worldview of that particular series of movies. Before the break, Ty was on the line, Brian, and he asked about the real malignancy of this movie, talking about the depiction of evil in this movie. What form does it take?
Well, you know, in The Matrix Reloaded, I was saying, in the original Matrix, I think one of the things I read about it in my book is I tell people the basic elements of story structure that we in Hollywood use, writers and directors, to tell stories, and how that story structure sort of leads you through the redemption of a main character, the protagonist or the hero. And Neo, being the hero in the first Matrix, his self-discovery out of ignorance, he was ignorant of his true identity of the nature of reality, and he becomes enlightened of the true nature of reality. That is a very clear Eastern Gnostic worldview, and so the malignancy in that first movie is really about ignorance, not waking up and repenting from one's sin or wrongs, but rather waking up to our ignorance. And in the second movie, I think that they're still struggling with the nature of finding out what's really going on, and we see, you know, we're given some glimpses into twists that are going to be revealed in the third movie, I'm sure, about really ultimately what it's all about. But in the meantime, I think that, you know, the malignancy in that movie that runs through it really is just, you know, AI, basically AI is trying to control people. It's control. Control is the theme. And like I said, it deals with determinism versus free will, but the real issue is control and who is in control. And, of course, the artificial intelligence is fighting for control. Individuals like Neo want to think that we have control because we don't like being controlled by other people. So who has the right to control us? And yet we discover many things end up being programs that we thought were free will, you know? So that's what I would probably say it would be control, and AI is trying to control them. And of course, Agent Smith becomes a renegade program himself in a way, and he causes multiple problems in the second movie as well.
Now, you mentioned before that the basic philosophy of the two movies is based upon the tenet that there is no reality, there's just multiple copies of reality. There are scenes here that just seem to reinforce this in both the movies, but in the second one in particular, since it's freshest in my mind, where you think you're seeing a scene and then it suddenly resolves and you pull back and you're watching a screen.
Yes.
And this happens from the opening credits throughout the movie.
Yes.
And in particular, at the climax of the movie as well, where one never knows whether one is watching the real thing.
Yes.
Or something else.
Absolutely. So I think that theme was carried on, that I suspect that what we think is real all along, it's going to be somewhat different than what we thought, you know, as part of the twist in the last movie. And just what exactly, I don't know. I mean, if they do follow Jean Baudrillard, maybe Neo, you know, in this movie, there's some implication that maybe what you think the real world, there's something going on there too. You don't know. And, you know, Neo's able to do some things that he didn't anticipate in the real world. And so maybe they'll wake up and see that what they thought was the real world isn't the real world. I don't know. That would follow Baudrillard more so and be more postmodern, or maybe not. Maybe they're just going to try to stick to the conventions of movies and come up with a different kind of theme, you know?
Someone's driving home, Brian, and they're listening to our conversation, and they say, look, I just like the kung fu and the bullet time scenes. Why make such a big deal? You know, the special effects are great. Why go so deep into it and make such a big deal out of it?
Well, you know, I think we have to really recognize, or we have to learn that, yes, it's true. It's entertainment, and an important part of entertainment is to enjoy and to, you know, sit back and enjoy. But movies are art. Movies are storytelling, and storytelling is art. And all art communicates a worldview in one way or another. Sure, some is more subtle than another, but the nature of storytelling itself really is about communicating values, communicating cultural myths, communicating beliefs and worldviews to people through the incarnation of drama. And so whether or not you think that, whether or not an individual thinks that a movie is communicating worldview, it is. And the less you are aware of that, the more easily you will be manipulated, whether you think so or not, whether you like it or not. And a good example of this kind of thing might be, you know, if you've ever found yourself laughing at a movie and enjoying it, but then afterwards someone may mention something and it strikes you, oh, I was laughing at things that I really don't believe are ultimately good, you know. My friend told a story about Bridges of Madison County, where some women, he was around some women, they were talking about how great the movie was when it came out, and romantic and all this and that, and he goes, and then they ask him, did you see that movie? And he said, you mean the one that was about adultery? And the women looked at him and they stopped and they said, wow, I didn't think of it that way. You're right, it is all about adultery. And so I think that a movie, by being so entertaining, you can get caught up into it and not be aware, not be discerning. Now, that doesn't mean you should just, you know, attack movies and, you know, like some of the moral watchdogs in society, just point out everything that's wrong with movies, and that's all they do, and look at how bad they are, and look at how bad Hollywood is. Because there is a lot of good, a lot of challenging thoughts in movies that make us think about and test us and give us opportunities to discuss deeper issues, and that's the purpose of art, is to stimulate the discussion and get you thinking, you know. And so anyway, that would be my conclusion on that. And I write about that in my book, you know, where, you know, the idea is the more you understand about the nature of storytelling, the more you can appreciate, pick out things and be discerning and be more objective and less manipulated.
I like movies that make me a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
One of the elements of this, a lot in this movie, The Matrix Reloaded, made me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Not for moral reasons, but for basic theological and philosophical reasons. One of them that made me most uncomfortable and is left unresolved in my mind is the whole issue of religious disillusionment. The major religious theme, without giving away the plot, the major religious theme in this movie at the end, we are told, is actually a lie. Or at least we're left with the impression that it is a lie.
Yeah.
And I find that deeply disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
is this a slap at, you know, you people who think you have religious certainty, you might just be believing a lie?
Yeah, I would say so. Or again, it's the demythologizing that takes place in movies like Planet of the Apes and AI, you know, where it's sort of like it's intended to educate. It's intended to show us, you know, oh look, this is where these kinds of beliefs come from, and so therefore you have to sort of grow up or get educated and realize that the things you believe in are just simply, you know, again, symbolic expressions of what you don't understand that really has ultimately a scientific explanation of some sort. Things like that, sure. But I'm not sure how clear that was in the ending, but I think we'll probably see for sure by the third movie.
Now, as a story, you talk quite a bit in your book, as you just mentioned, about the power of story, the compelling and possibly manipulative nature of a good story. As a story, how does this movie, both freestanding and as the sequel to the first, how does it stand up in your estimation?
Well, I think it stands up really well because, first of all, the problem with sequels is that oftentimes, you know, in order to keep the vigor and the interest that the first movie creates on these hit movies, the rule is you have to do more. So you have to have more explosions, more action, more drama, more of everything, and that's what they tend to do. But what you really want to do is you want to sort of capture and maintain the original spirit of the first movie, but give it a new angle. And I think they do that in this movie by, like I said, the first movie, it wrestles with what is the nature of reality and what you thought was real. That's a real deep issue. Then that's a good one. And in the second one, they really wrestle with the issue of free will, determinism, causality, and chance. And again, it's a new theme, but it maintains the depth by dealing with, you know, one of those important issues that philosophy has debated all through history. And so in that sense, it maintained the depth that I was personally looking for. But then, of course, they have, you know, more and bigger karate fight scenes than the first one. What they're going to do for the last one, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to top it, you know.
But, I don't know either.
Yeah, usually by third sequels, it's just more of the same, you know. But I'm hoping that in the third one, they'll maintain the depth by bringing out a new deep theme that's different from the first two or not as developed in the first two that will make it be as thoughtful. And I think that's what makes The Matrix so unique is thoughtfulness. In the midst of this kung fu chop-socky movie, you've got this deep, thoughtful worldview paradigm that's being addressed. And I think that's what made it so unique and original, so they're trying to maintain that. And I think they did that in this one, you know. But at the same time, I think they pulled back on a little bit on the religious imagery and focused more on the philosophical issues. But
there's also in the first movie, you wouldn't have gotten the impression that, except for one character, there's anyone who didn't believe that the prophecy was true and that Neo was the savior from the Matrix.
Yeah.
But in the second one, we discovered that there's a whole segment of humanity, so to speak, that don't believe any of this prophecy, religious stuff at all.
You know, one great line in there was when someone says that to Morpheus, and Morpheus says, "My beliefs do not require that other people believe them." In other words, it's the truth whether or not you believe it, you know? And I think that sort of brings us back to a little notion of the objective reality we're talking about, you know?
What about there's a scene that is close to that one, down in Zion, where Morpheus addresses apparently the whole human population.
Yeah.
And it's a very rousing speech, but it is very much kind of a triumph of the human person speech. And then it's followed by a very extended sequence of kind of...
A rave. A rave orgy is what
it is. A rave orgy sensuality all mixed together.
And that's, of course, that is, of course, more a Dionysian, pagan worship concept than anything else, which is interesting because the cavern that they meet at, they call the temple. The talk that they're giving the people, they call a prayer. And if you notice... They take their shoes off before they enter it because, of course, it's holy ground, right? And then they have the Dionysian sort of dancing orgy, which these are all elements of the Hellenistic Dionysian religion, you know. It lines up very, very strongly with that, and I think which ultimately is a celebration of the sensuality of the human, you know, human body, among other things, you know.
But it is intercut with a what is supposed to be, I think, an actual, and I mean this in all seriousness, a love scene.
Yeah.
Of two people who are supposed to really love each other. And there you've got rave orgy intercut with married love.
Yeah.
What is that? What is the message that's being sent here?
I don't know, but it sure is confusing and, you know, sort of typical of movies like that where they, you know, maybe they, I don't know, maybe they felt like they needed to spice up what would be boring, committed love because it was no longer the hot and erotic, forbidden love. I don't know. But one thing I did want to add to that was one of the things that I think undercuts the movie, and I don't know if other people that felt this, but I honestly did, and that was, you know, when they, of course, in this movie, they finally show Zion, and they go down there, and we see what Zion's like in the life of the people. And, you know, I got to admit, the Zion part of the movie was the most boring part to me. I couldn't wait. I kept saying, get back into the Matrix, you know, which sort of undercuts the whole idea that reality is better than the illusion, you know. And, you know, I don't think they were intending that. I just think that the way they set it up sort of made it kind of boring, you know.
I was telling someone here in the studio before we came on the air that the first thing I thought when I walked out of the movie was, I love the movie, great movie, kept me riveted, but it could have gone one more pass through the editor's office, one more to cut a little of the length out there. What do you think, Brian, about sequel mania, movies that are now being written not as standalone stories, but as the first in three or first in two?
Franchises, I mean, it's automatically attempted that way. And, you know, there's much of Hollywood... that I agree with Michael Medved that there's much of Hollywood that is driven by personal agenda and worldviews. You know, they make a lot of movies that don't make money because they are trying to get their worldview and values out there. But there is much of Hollywood that is based on the bottom line being the dollar. And basically what happens is with sequels, if you know you have a hit movie, they've worked out actuarial tables or whatever you call them where they know that there's a certain percent of percentage of money based on what the movie makes in its first release that they'll make. They know exactly what they'll make on a second release, so they can gear and gauge their income. They'll know how much is going to be made, because the problem is in Hollywood is many movies are made, and it's going to sound weird, but you never really know if a movie's going to be a hit or not. There have been many movies that people are confident are a hit and end up being falling flat. There are movies that they thought would just fall flat, but they end up being a hit. And so Hollywood recognizes that you never really know. But if money is a bottom line, which it is, they really require that they make money. And so sequels and franchises are certain money makers that they really bank on, and as well as adaptations of books like Harry Potter, which is the perfect thing. It's an adaptation of a best-selling book that is also a series, you know. And so those are the things that they're drawn to simply because they have a certain amount of certainty that they'll make a certain amount of money, whereas other movies you just never know.
Now, one that may be exception to this, and I'd like you to contrast the worldviews, if you would, because you have also talked and written on this as well. One that was written intentionally as a three-movie set was the Ring trilogy, the Tolkien Lord of the Rings trilogy, because it's three books to begin with.
Yeah.
Contrast the worldview in that series of movies, of which we now have two, with the worldview that is put forth in The Matrix, of which we now have two.
Well, you know, I'd say that there's some definite similarities, and partly because one of the common themes in fantasy as well as science fiction is precisely the dehumanization of humanity through technology. And in fantasy, it's usually about the loss of magic. You know, magic is a metaphor for the mystery of life. And so oftentimes magic, and same thing with Harry Potter, magic becomes a metaphor for people who sort of can experience the mystery of our existential experience. And those who don't, or aren't in the magic, they're the muggles, or they're the people who don't, you know, who are so scientific. So really a lot of fantasy and sci-fi is about how science has drained our humanity. That's the Michael Crichton. He does a lot of those. You know, Jurassic Park, you know, it's all about how we think we're gods and we employ technology and it turns around and bites us in the butt. And so in Lord of the Rings, you know, you see Saruman, you know, and his whole essence was just very anti-nature, destructive of nature, because he just wanted power and he used science and he didn't care about nature and he destroyed nature because of it. And I think that's a very, you know, powerful truth, you know. And, of course, in The Matrix, it's very similar. You know, machines get to the point where we build machines to the point where they take over and they fight us and take over, and then they drain our humanity literally from us, not just figuratively. So that's what most sci-fi movies are about. It's the struggle of humanity and technology, and usually how technology dehumanizes us, which I think is a good theme to deal with.
And yet the Matrix, as we've said, those two movies so far seem to present a view of reality as shifting sand.
Yes.
Whereas the Ring trilogy seems to present a very different view of truth, of reality.
Exactly. And, you know, the Ring trilogy, as we know, is you know, based on a worldview of a Christian Catholic. And his notion is look, just because a movie has good and evil in it, many people think that that's like, oh, that's a good movie because it has good and evil in it. Every movie has good and evil. The question is, how is evil and good defined? And just because a movie has a strong good and evil element to it doesn't make it true or Christian at all. And in The Lord of the Rings, of course, yeah, the good and evil is stark, but evil is focused around power and the nature of power, and goodness is focused around the nature of maybe humility and giving up power. So the one person who can save the earth is the person who's humble enough to give up the power, as we all know, Frodo, you know. And it contrasts those two elements, whereas I think, you know, in The Matrix, it's more a matter of everyone is using power, and that's another postmodern theme. There is no real ultimate absolute truth. There's just people fighting for power, and so you can use power for good or power for evil. And I think that's also the theme in Harry Potter. It's all about just using power for good rather than relinquishing power, because power is corrupting, you know. So that's why I think there might be some differences in there as well.
Let's spend the last few minutes of our conversation, Brian, talking about if we understand the worldviews presented by these various films, but in particular, let's focus on the one presented by the Matrix films. If we understand this, how can it give us opportunity to speak the gospel?
Oh, just tremendous opportunity. I mean, look, if that's a hit movie, that's what everyone's talking about. If you're able to watch that movie and to discern what you think might be good or truthful, some true elements in it, you know, and then be able to discern where you disagree, well, the next time your friends and buddies are talking about it and you get into a deep discussion, you're able to discern, you're able to tell people, well, yeah, here's what I liked about it. I thought this was clever. I noticed these religious elements. I noticed they struggle with these philosophical issues. But guess what? You know, here's where the Eastern view of the Christ comes in, and that's Neo in waking up from his ignorance, becoming an example or model for other people to save themselves. But here's where that differs. That's really, people think that that's the Jesus, that's what Jesus was like. But guess what? I've read the Bible, and that's not how Jesus or the Christ is in the Bible. Here's how it differs. And then you explain the true Christian Christ story, and you're able to use that as an opportunity. And I don't mean in a manipulative way, using it as an opportunity. It's just simply, look, you know, these movies bring up these issues, and these issues are very strong, very religious, very worldview-oriented. Well, in the midst of discussing that worldview, you're going to discuss your worldview take on that. So I think it's just a great and wonderful opportunity to be able to share your faith in a very non-threatening and sort of, you know, we're always looking for a way to talk about our faith that would be relevant and not be artificially pushed on the discussion. Well, here's a great, perfect chance. You know, you don't have to come out of nowhere and say, well, what do you think about Jesus? you can actually talk about the Matrix, and of course, in talking about it, you're going to be addressing the issue of the Christ story. And that's a very natural, in other words, it's evangelism in a very natural way.
With only a minute before we go, to the person who says, look, I don't take part in anything Hollywood produces, and if I saw this movie, I could only register my moral indignation at the language, at the sensuality, and at the violence.
Well, you know, I write a lot about this in my book, Hollywood Worldviews, and I think that, personally, I think there's a couple levels that need to be addressed there. First of all, just because the movie's rated R, just because it has violence and sex in it, doesn't mean it's not acceptable for adults, because the Bible has a lot of sex and violence in it, and the Bible is rated R in many places. And if you want to read more about that, I've also got it on my website and in my book. But, you know, and so to me, if the Bible has this stuff in it, then it's not a question of is it okay to watch sex and violence? It's a question of, in what appropriate context, or in what context is it appropriate to have that? And then secondly, there's the element of, the Apostle Paul went through Mars Hill, and he talked to the pagans of his day, and, he was able to quote their own philosophers back to them, which means he studied pagan godless philosophers who worshipped Zeus and the like. And so that means that he was very familiar with the movies of his day, shall we say. And that enabled him to be able to talk to them and share the gospel with them in a very redemptively interactive way. So if you want to be able to redemptively interact with your culture, I think you're going to have to see movies like The Matrix that are very, very influential on that culture, even if you don't agree with it. And then lastly, I think that...
Just about 30 seconds.
And then lastly, I would say, again, movies are a mixture of good and bad. It's not all bad, and there can be some very good, stimulating, thoughtful things that movies can strike up in you. Just because you don't agree with the whole worldview doesn't mean you can't learn things from it. So that's how I would conclude.
Brian Gadawa, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues,
Etc.
Brian Gadawa is a screenwriter in Southern California. He's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Movies with Wisdom and Discernment, and some additional writings by Brian appear on his website, Gadawa.com. That's Gadawa, GODAWA.com. When we come back from this break, the conclusion to our series with Dr. Arthur Hunt on a word-based culture versus an image-dependent culture. We'll talk about the paganizing tendency of the image and the irrationality of what Dr. Hunt calls spectacle. And apparently so much of what we view now has become mere spectacle. We'll find out what it means to be a pagan and postmodern right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.